overthinking it, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve. This is the Overthinking It Book Club, and we are reading Slaughterhouse-Five. This is the fifth installment of our six-part series, and we'll be discussing chapters 9 and 10. I'm Ben Adams, and with me is a whole panel of overthinkers. A quick reminder slash plug for next week. We're finishing the book this week, but we will have one more week of book club to talk about the 1970s film adaptation of Slaughterhouse-Five. So you can get that from a variety of locations, but we do have a affiliate link up on the show notes for this episode, which you can get rent it streaming through Amazon for just a few bucks. So if you want to watch the film and talk about it next week and kick Overthinking It back a little percentage of that, we'd appreciate it. So we'll start off and just introduce the panel. First, we have the world's foremost expert on Slaughterhouse-Five, Shana Mulosky. Hey, Shana.
Hey, Ben. I was just looking at my notes, and I said that Montana Wild Hacks locket, and this is a typo, but it has the Serenity prayer on it, and I am amused because boobies. So we can talk about Serenity prayer later. But I just want to note that right now because I just saw it and I am amused by myself. Anyway, go on.
I love it.
God grant me the wisdom to stare at the boobs that I can stare at, to ignore the boobs that I can't stare at, and the wisdom to know the difference. Oh, God, please, the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah, last part is crucial.
Extremely important. Next, we have Richard Rosenbaum. Hey, Richard.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. I enjoyed finally finishing the book. I think I'm the only one that didn't cheat, so.
Oh, no.
Good job, Ben.
I also didn't finish
until
like yesterday or something, so there
now
you go.
Now we're all the world's foremost experts. No, it's really me.
No, it's you. Yeah. The rest of us are just the world's second most experts.
So. Yeah, because you read it in high school.
I know. Jesus imagery, guys.
I know.
There's more in this section.
Yep.
But next we have Jordan Stokes. Hey, Jordan.
Just reminding you guys, you can't spell Slaughterhouse-Five without Laughterhouse-Five.
Laughter-ho-five. Serenity prayer. Okay, moving along.
And last, Matt Rather.
Hi. I suppose they'll all want dignity now.
All the podcasters will want dignity now.
Yeah, now that there's 7 billion podcasters in the world. actually, according to Google, the population is 7.046 billion podcasters in the world, and only passed the 7 billion mark within the last year or two. I guess in 2011 or 2012, according to the Oracle of Google. So Vonnegut was wrong, guys, when in that last chapter he has O'Hare's little factoid book say that the world population will be at 7 billion by the year 2000. He was wrong. His book is invalid.
Well, I've seen that. It's interesting that you say that there are 7 billion podcasters, because I also learned today that about 100,000 podcasters die every day of starvation. Well, I mean, attention starvation.
It's because they can't buy food with the without ads
their
on
podcast
the,
money.
Without ads on the podcast.
Unlike us.
Yeah, yeah, Audible.com is the world's greatest monster.
Don't say that word unless they're paying us money for it.
I mean, notable.com.
But we start with Billy in the hospital, and like with Valencia's death. And I thought that the like I don't know, it's sort of interesting, right? Like chapter 9, we've been talking about the Jesus imagery because Shana keeps insisting that it's there.
I don't believe her.
Yeah. And at the beginning of chapter 9 is, here is how Billy Pilgrim lost his wife, Valencia. You know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of the gospel where the nativity story is prefixed with, now this is how the birth of Jesus Christ came about. Right? Like, that's a, you know, that's a sort of, tell him what you're going to tell him, and then tell him what you told him move.
Well, the funny thing about the Jesus imagery in this book is that it, I said it was there at the beginning, and few believed me. They didn't have faith in it, and then it went away. But now it's coming back to life right here at the end. So, yeah, I think we should focus on that. Okay, thank you, Stokes, for giving me a reaction. I don't care if it is ironic. So, thank you.
No, I think that's kind of funny. It's meta Jesus imagery.
Well, I mean, that's a good point, rather. I am Jewish, so I would not have noticed that. So,
yeah, I don't
thumbs
even know
up.
Who you guys are talking about.
I want to say that at the beginning of chapter 9, what I noticed, which was interesting, was that you got the professor Bertram Copeland Rumford, who is from Harvard, so boo. And it was interesting that he is in there because he was skiing and he broke a bone, and he's on his honeymoon, which is an interesting reversal, because Billy crashed into a ski slope and then his wife just had died, you know, previous to this one little scene. So Vonnegut is setting him up immediately as sort of the foil to Billy. So maybe that's something we could explore along with the Jesus stuff.
Yeah, he's the anti-Billy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you will know him by his number, 666. We should talk about Rumford, right? How do you say that? How have you guys been pronouncing that in your head as you silently read along? Or do you read out loud to yourselves, right? Rumford is like this sort of geriatric Superman, right? With a wife who is a sort of stock figure of misogynist fun, right? Who is a go-go girl who can't read, and is scared of Billy, right? He scares me, the guy, and he's like, no, let Big Daddy Air Force historian come and watch you. You know, he's not even living. They should get a tree surgeon to work on this guy. But the thing that he says when he and Billy finally talk about Dresden that I think is interesting is like, well, you know, pity the people who have to do it, right? Like, and that is an interesting. It's presented in the mouth of a guy who I think we're definitely not supposed to like very much. But I don't know. That's a pretty profound point, I think, right? Like, the point that Vonnegut is making, near as I can tell with that line anyway, is that there's dehumanization all the way around, right? It's terrible. You don't suffer equally, perhaps, but it's terrible. It's terrible to be an agent of destruction. And you don't want to like draw equivalences between two things, but like one of the important things that I thought when I was reading these fake introductions was that like both things can be true, right? Like two things can be bad without getting into a lot of arm wrestling about what's worse, right? Like the destruction of Dresden the destruction of Dresden forward by Eaker. I don't know if these are real people, or if these are real texts, because there are some real intertexts and some sort of fake intertexts. But like, I find it difficult to understand Englishmen or Americans who weep about enemy civilians who were killed, but have not shed a tear for our gallant crews lost in combat with a cruel enemy. That is to say, it's sort of presented as a false dichotomy, right? That you kind of, you're either on the side of the, you know, hippie peaceniks, or else you're on the side of the patriotic Americans who remember the toll that so many paid for freedom, right? Like both things can be true and both things can be bad. And this sort of, you're either with us or against us kind of logic doesn't really help us very much.
Can I talk about one of the other guys who wrote either a foreword or some other notes on the destruction of Dresden? I'm thinking specifically of Air Marshal Sonbies, which I wrote down. And he says that the destruction of Dresden was, quote, one of those terrible things that happened in wartime, brought about by an unfortunate combination of circumstances. Those who approved it were neither wicked nor cruel. So that goes to your point, rather. Well, then he goes on to say, though it may be that they were too remote from the harsh realities of war to understand fully what they were doing, which is a fascinating point because this whole book we've been saying for weeks and weeks is about making us feel alienated for the war. So it's as if Vonnegut is making us remote and therefore sort of putting us on the same level as the people who approved the bombing to begin with. So we're not really allied with the people on the ground, at least at this point in this chapter, and even when we're there, we're sort of removed from it. And I wonder, as you said, rather, if he's trying to make us, in a weird way, empathize with the people who didn't empathize, if that makes any sense.
Well, I think it's meant to be. I mean, it's sort of in a sense empathy all the way down. I mean, I think that the line that's crucial is
all the way down, following the trail of the incendiary bomb onto Dresden.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, I think it's important that, like, this is kind of Billy Pilgrim's view of that kind of everything. You know, things occur because that's the way the moment is structured, and I think that's sort of the view. I think you particularly see it around. Discussions of World War One, I think, is seen in this light much more so than World War Two. But I think the conventional view of World War One is that it was these kind of on both sides had these political structures that made the slaughter inevitable in some sense, that you had these secret alliances and just a set of interests that made it so that when one thing happened, all these dominoes fell. And it was tragic, and there was horrible things that occurred on both sides, and lots of people died. And I think that's the conventional view of World War One. And I think this is trying to push back a little bit on that, the sense of World War Two as being 100% a good guys versus bad guys affair. And it's entirely possible that the Nazis are both, 100% evil, and that this is not just a good guys versus bad guys affair. But like those, as you said, Matt, both of those things can be true at the same time.
It's interesting to compare this to the other big kind of World War II was not a sacred war book, which is Catch-22, right? Where there you get a sense that everything that's happening is inevitable, but it's because of systems that exist. Right, and you sort of like begin to see the outline of the system, that it's about capitalism or it's about military careerism or it's about something like that. And although there are very many sort of wicked, self-serving people, none of them are really choosing to have this happen. They're all just sort of caught up in the system. Whereas with Vonnegut, it seems it's more cosmic than that even, right? Which, like, you get into the wars that the Trafalmadorians have, right? That even without people to have wars, there would still be wars because that's the way that it's not even one moment, right? That's the way that life is structured. So that questions of blame almost become, meaningless, right? But that does mean that it's not just good guys versus bad guys, that it's just the thing that happened.
Yeah, we do get part of that in the discussion, the very brief discussion between Rumford and Billy, right? Where Rumford says, "It had to be done," and Billy says, "I know," and they both see it as having been inevitable in a way, except that Rumford sees it as morally necessary, right? That it was something that had to be done for moral reasons, whereas Billy doesn't mean that at all. He means it's kind of like ontologically necessary.
Of course, it's interesting because I think, I don't know what the scholarship at the time, and I'm sure there's a great deal of debate about it still today, but the tense that Rumford uses, it had to be done, as in even post hoc, after the fact, it was still justified. Whereas I think a more common interpretation today, and historians correct me on the forums, but I think a more common interpretation today is at the time, the people who ordered it believed it had to be done. But now we know after the fact, most likely it had very little effect on either the German ability to make war or the German morale of making war. That I think most people now would say that it didn't accomplish the goals that were set out for the bombing of Dresden, which isn't to necessarily morally condemn the action in terms of, you know, you can only judge these things, generally speaking, prospectively. What did they know at the time? But Rumford seems desperate to say that it's still justified today.
Now, I think what's interesting about Rumford doing that, you don't get the sense until that one little conversation that he thinks there's anything wrong with it, right? That he's not even trying to justify it. He's trying to talk about sort of how great it was in his account, I think. But when he's talking to Billy, who was there on the ground, he then needs to justify it. And you don't get the feeling that he really wants to justify it to Billy because he doesn't care about Billy. He wants to justify it to himself. Faced with Billy, he has to justify it to himself. And I think it's really interesting that what Billy wants from Rumford is not an apology, not a you know, justification. He wants Rumford to acknowledge that he was there. That's all that he wants. And here I feel like the scale of whether Vonnegut is supposed to be Billy or Vonnegut is supposed to be the Vonnegut narrator or Vonnegut is supposed to be Kilgore Trout, it really tips to Billy because that's what he keeps saying, right? I was there. I was there. I saw this happen. And here you have, I think, the closest thing to a justification for why Vonnegut is writing the book. He feels like the simple act of bearing witness, saying, I did see this thing that occurred, will have an effect on the Rumfords of the world.
Right. Well, I think that Rumford seems to be trying to get into an argument with Billy, and Billy's just not having it. It's very one-sided, right?
It's, well, yeah, ironically, right after having ignored him and also sort of derided him for being weak, right? Oh, he's a vegetable. They should get a veterinarian or a tree doctor out here to look at that vegetable. And I mean, it's sort of very poignantly contrasted with the name, with the mission of the hospital, right, which is to help the weak. And Rumford wants to sort of obliterate the weak.
Yeah, and he's trying to get into an argument with Billy, like he expects Billy to take the opposite opinion, to take the opposite side, that no, actually, it didn't have to be done, it shouldn't have been done, and all this stuff, and Billy completely doesn't take up that side. And I think similarly, you can't argue with the book that Vonnegut has written, right? It's not a conversation. And he's not really, seemingly not making any real points, except, you know, in the very beginning, we get the idea that he's not trying to make, he's not trying to write a pro-war book, you know, that'll get turned into a big movie with explosions and that makes it look glorious. But you also don't get the kind of war is hell book that you'd expect. So it's kind of hard to, I think it's deliberately hard to argue with it or hard to take it on because it's so alienating, seems so distant.
Well, Vonnegut's always sort of setting up the arguments against whatever he's saying and then either knocking them down or agreeing with them. He's constantly contradicting himself, sort of what you were implying. Or one example, since you guys were talking about Rumford and how he thinks the weak should die, there was a line also where he was contrasted with the hospital staff who want to help the weak, because they want that nobody should die. And there's this interesting tension here because, I guess this whole chapter, or actually this chapter and the next chapter, have been not just about the inevitability of war, but also the inevitability of death or weakness and age and death. So there's this idea here that maybe nobody should die. And in, what am I saying? Billy Pilgrim thinks that nobody dies really because they live forever in this weird time loop, and therefore people are kind of meaningless. They have no effect on their lives or anyone else's lives. It just sort of happens to them. On the other hand, if people do die and they do have some control, but then everyone, you know, passes away at some point, you know, they have no purpose either. And I think that's kind of what Vonnegut is. I mean, he's a little bit contradicting himself too, but I think he's saying that both if death is inevitable, then we have no purpose in the world, and if war is inevitable, we have no purpose in the world, but if either of them are not inevitable and we're not stopping them, then we have no purpose because we're not doing it correctly. So it's just it's a very cynical view, I think.
It's an internet threat, right? You're doing it wrong.
Yeah. Or you're not doing it wrong because you can't do anything. Either way, you know, that's what I think he's getting at.
That's I don't know. I mean,
he also Godwin's laws it pretty hard.
Well,
go ahead.
It's a World War II book. You can't.
That's no excuse.
Yeah, I think there's an exception to Godwin's law for actual discussions of World War II.
Of actual World War II.
Anyway, go ahead.
I guess we should save this for the end when we sort of address the whole book. But I want to put on our agenda for that the supposed fatalism of this work and. To what extent this position that's advanced by a number of people in different ways throughout the novel is actually endorsed by the author, or to what extent it's a tactic to get you to get you to kind of think about it or to kind of express something about his experience in a certain way.
I mean, I agree with that point, too. I'm going to contradict myself in 5 minutes, I'm sure, because I've said on other podcasts that I agree with what you were just saying, that by being fatalistic, he's sort of trying to make us less fatalistic. So basically, everything I just said, ignore it.
Well,
you're in good company.
I'll have more to say. I'll have more to say about this, I suppose, anon.
With that pin, let me move us on to the incident with Billy and the horses in Dresden. That's kind of the next event after we get this discussion of Rumford and Lily in the hospital. What do people make of this one time that Billy broke down and cried during the war?
Well, there's some Jesus imagery, right? I mean, explicitly, although it's really funny because Vonnegut uses italics to be like, all right, in this specific case, Billy is like Christ, sort of implying that in all the other cases, he wasn't, or he was set up as a Christ figure, but it was supposed to be a parody. But in this particular case, when the fact that he doesn't usually cry is therefore makes him like the baby. Baby Jesus. That was amusing to me.
Well, it's interesting because it's not quite accurate, right? Like that, what he's saying is that Billy sort of weeps silently to himself. He just kind of, I don't know what he does, kind of shudders, maybe doesn't even tear up. He just sort of, he just kind of shakes or sobs silently. It's the noiselessness, right? That is his point of comparison with Jesus. That like the cattle are lowing, the baby awakes, but little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes.
Well, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, do we ever actually hear or see, definitely not towards the end, Jesus actually saying anything in this book, whether in Kilgore Trout's books or, you know, do they ever quote anything he says? Because all I remember in here is we see Jesus as a baby, not crying, not making any sound. And we also see Jesus being taken down off the cross, or actually building his own cross first, getting put on it, and then being taken down, and a time traveler coming to make sure that he's actually dead, and he is. He's dead as a doornail. So we have Christ being brought up over and over again, but is pretty much completely silent and useless.
Yeah, hey, you know what? If you're going to give a guy a hard time, just make sure he's not well-connected.
Yeah. True.
Yeah.
Also, he was pretty short, which is not surprising, but now we know. Thank you, Kilgore Trout.
I think symbolically, it's very rich, and there's a lot there's a lot to kind of unpack here, right? Like to say that like Billy cried and this was the one thing that made Billy cry was the sort of suffering of the horses, right? I mean, it's probably because the animals are so completely innocent, right? Like so uncontroversially innocent, and their suffering and his indifference to their suffering kind of drives home the horror of our inhumanity to our fellow creatures. But like Billy crying, I nearly said Jesus crying, reminds me of the Jesus wept passage, which I believe is in John chapter 11 or thereabouts, and it's about the death of Lazarus, right? Not Lazarus the beggar covered in sores, the other Lazarus, the one who dies and is resurrected, and he dies, sort of goes below the ground, and he's in the he's in the tomb, right? Like Jesus rolls the stone away from the tomb in John 11 and says, "Lazarus, come out." And Lazarus comes out. And it prefigures the Easter narrative in the Gospels, and which I think is also sort of activated here by the reference to like actually checking on Jesus on the cross to see if he's dead. But like the thing that I think is so rich about it, right, is that what they call the corpse mine, right? The corpse mines, the graves, the tombs, underground bunkers, kind of like the underground bunkers containing corpses, kind of like the tomb of Lazarus or the tomb of Jesus, are travesties, are kind of horrific travesties of the tomb of Lazarus or of Jesus, right? Like they are. So absurdly horrible, just with flame, you know, eventually just flamethrowers going in to flash cremate everybody because the corpses start to rot and liquefy, a particularly hideous description, right?
Well, there's another Jesus thing there, right? That's the harrowing of hell is what that is.
Sure. Yeah, non-gospel. Yeah, non-gospel stuff. But yeah, right.
That just made me think of Guardians of the Galaxy.
in the Jesus Extended Universe fanfic.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, there's a thing that after he dies, he goes down to hell and lets
with a flamethrower.
Yes.
And the 70s soundtrack is, you know, really A+ for me.
Yeah, and he lets out all of the souls of the people who were good people but had the misfortune to die before Jesus was there and therefore had to go to hell anyway, which is a interesting belief, but anyway. And they all get to go up to heaven, right?
Howard the Duck.
Yes, yes.
Isn't all of Western literature, in a way, isn't all of Western literature the Jesus Extended Universe fanfic?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, but it's all in the
wait. Yeah, that's
a
Jewish fanfic. Hey.
Yeah, it's all in the mind of an autistic child.
Boy.
But it's interesting in this case that he's still. What is the thing that they go into, right? The first thing that they make contact with is they go through the roof of a church, right? And the people are there, and they're all at that particular moment pure, right? But then they immediately start to rot. So it's very, very Jesus imagery all over the place. But again, a travesty of it.
Yeah, and I mean, sort of speaks to the kind of deep structure, the kind of very deep, the deep game that Vonnegut is playing on a you know, a metaphorical level after last week's backwards gospel from Golgotha to the manger, you know.
Well, we could also transition, I guess, if we don't want to continue talking about Jesus, which we could, but the fact that they're bringing up the corpses, or they're trying to bring up the corpses from the mines and then, you know, burning them in this travesty. And then, of course, in, you know, a few sentences, it's just we're told that Edgar Derby, just from one of those little holes, gets his teapot gets shot, so it goes, which is just, you know, obviously there's this interesting juxtaposition of what they're doing, what the Germans are doing to these bodies who used to be people versus, you know, Jerby just taking a little relic and everyone else is taking stuff, you know, ceremonial sabers, etc. And for, you know, no reason really, just getting offed for it.
Well, it's interesting also because that the cavalierness with the Germans execute Derby is mirrored by the cavalierness that Vonnegut kills him off, which is interesting because we've been building up to this. Like, this has been the big thing that we, this is the fireworks factor that we've been promised the whole episode. And we've been told over and over again that this is really important thing that's going to happen, which is that Edgar Derby is going to be shot. And that's going to, like, somehow be the this very important event in this book. And then we get to the end and it, You could easily, if you were like really excited to get to the end of the book, if your eyes like skipped down the page too fast and you were like scanning, you could easily just miss the entire event happening because it goes by so quickly. And it doesn't really pass with any more analysis or comment than any other of the, you know, thousands of deaths in the book.
The trip to New York in the middle of this is sort of interesting, isn't it? Right, with the dirty bookstore section where we get a callback not only to the woman copulating with the horse,
Deedley Balls. I have to say
attempting to copulate with the horse.
Yeah, sure. I guess so. Right, like that would have been. You know, after the horses make Billy Pilgrim cry for the only time in the war. Oh, and also he's armed for the only time in the war. Did that detail perk anyone's up? And he's armed with the most ridiculous weapon, a sort of ornate World War I pistol that seems to be of very little practical use for self defense. You know, he's sort of a person who's always kind of comically, I mean, he's, you know, spastic in time, yes, but is also sort of, even when he is where he is at the time that he's there, he seems always sort of incongruous with his circumstances. And so too in the adult bookstore where, the thing that draws him in there is Kilgore Trout, and they're like, "Why are you looking at those? Those are just window dressing. The real stuff is here. The lady's copulating with horses, and I can't pull it up now, but Vonnegut's description of the pornography and of the kind of just futility and kind of sadness of the pornography is really on point, I think.
There was an interesting parallel, or not a parallel exactly, a rhyme that Vonnegut puts in, which is that when Billy Pilgrim is going into the store, he's looking at the window and he sees the news ticker reflected in the glass, and the line is, "The window reflected the news. It was all about power and sports and anger and death." So that's the one.
I was
going to
bring up
the
same thing.
Do you want to say the second part of it?
Oh no, go on. I want to hear what you have to say first.
Well, so then he goes in, right? And he's interested in the stuff that's actually like in the window display, but that's not what the store is about, right? The world inside the store, it says that the people running the store didn't have hard-ons, neither did Billy Pilgrim. Everyone else did. It was a ridiculous store all about love and babies. So somewhere between the power and sports and anger and death, right, and the love and babies, you have this little membrane containing science fiction books. And this is what Billy Pilgrim is interested in, that nobody else in the world is interested in. And at this point in the story, I feel like Billy Pilgrim is someone that we're supposed to empathize with and like, right? In that he's not Rumford.
It's sort of counterfactual statement, though, the second one, right? Like, it's not all about love and babies. It's about sort of copulation, right? Like with,
well,
and it's sort of the movement from that to Montana Wild Hacks blue movies, which aren't about love and babies, to right. Her apotheosis as a mother on Tralfamador, Sorry, I'm sounding it out syllable by syllable. There's one L, and it's not where I thought it was initially. Right where she is nursing the baby and moving it from breast to breast, and Billy is staring at her boobs because those are the boobs that he can stare at, and you know, and that is her sort of, that is her kind of apotheosis, that is her telos, right? But no, maybe you think they are about love and babies to a certain extent.
I mean, I was thinking that it seemed like, not that the store is about love and babies, but a way to denigrate what love and babies are, right? To say that love and babies are actually about, like, copulation and the desire to propagate the species, and that every aspect of life that that you would call about love and babies, right? That, you know, that every beautiful love song that was ever written, every romantic novel, every, you know, art, family life, the whole sort of interior world that the 19th century conjures up is actually kind of a blind over a woman attempting to copulate with a horse.
Uh-huh.
And that the alternative to that is, you know, what was it again? Power and Sports and Anger and Death. Or there is the realm of ideas, which is sort of where Kilgore Trout hangs out and where Vonnegut aspires to hang out. That was my reading on
it. And it's sort of interesting that the just following on from what you're saying, the two Kilgore Trout books that are called out here are the Kidnapped People book, right, where they get put on display in a zoo in a planet called Zircon 212, and they actually see a ticker, a news ticker, right, in their captivity that is controlled by the aliens just to make them kind of jump, and they're not even being experimented on, they're being just they're being made to perform for crowds at the zoo. But this is, and then the other one is about a guy who wants to know whether Jesus is really dead. Those are the two Kilgore Trout books. And so here, like at that membrane, you know, the thing that sort of separates the two spheres that you're talking about, or the sort of the membrane between the two areas, is about like paranoia and skepticism, right? Like the idea that news ticker is controlled by a force we don't know, like to some sort of nefarious or kind of pointless end. And that sort of politics and finance and religion are all manipulations to kind of get us to perform for our alien overlords, fantasized by in the science fiction as alien, but you know, it sort of raises the question of who they actually are. And then the other book is about a guy who's like, well, is Jesus actually dead? He's a skeptic. He won't believe it until he sees it for himself.
Yeah, even the name of the planet speaks to that, right? The love and babies, that it's Zircon 212, which is like Zircon, it's itself an ersatz diamond.
Sure, right.
Right? And we're talking about, you've got a man and a woman trapped here together with this stuff that doesn't matter. And even the planet itself is named after, you know, like a cheap imitation of something that's supposed to symbolize love.
Can we also talk about that whole novel is dead scene? Because it just makes me laugh, and I think it really ties into what we're all talking about here. Because before Vonnegut talks about the news crawl and also, you know, love and babies, he has other lines that also sort of rhyme with that. He says that Billy wanted to watch something on TV, but at that hour it was all silliness and murder. And then he goes down and sees some books, and they're about, quote, fucking and buggery and murder. So we have silliness and murder and fucking and buggery and murder and power and sports and anger and death and love and babies. And they're all put on the same level, as you were saying, Matt, like just completely purposeless, you know, making us feel emotions and maybe react in a certain way, but it doesn't you know, just all manipulation. So all of that makes you think that Vonnegut is really anti-literature, anti-television, for the most part, just anti-narrative, which makes sense in this book, which doesn't really have much of a narrative, you would say. But then you have the scene where Billy is mistaken for a literary critic, and you have all these critics making the same critiques that you would think Vonnegut might make, that, you know, books are purposeless, they're just, you know, part of the whole capitalist machine, in that they're just making us perform, you know, acts of consumption, like we're buying the books so they look nice on the shelves, or the books are telling us what we should buy in the store for our wives. So, but the way he puts it through these literary critics, they're supposed to seem, I think, buffoonish, and we're supposed to, you know, mock them, or we're supposed to at least think of them negatively in contrast to Billy, who, as you said, Jordan, I think we're at this point supposed to like and even maybe a little bit identify with. So again, Vonnegut is sort of going back and forth, contradicting himself over and over again in the realm of literature, whether it's completely futile, like, you know, everything else he's trying to do, you know, is that useless, or is there something there that can be done through the art of literature, even if, yeah, you know, as it's as shitty as the Kilgore Trout stuff?
I mean, that's an excellent jumping off point to kind of transition off chapters 9 and 10 to talk about the book as a whole. What is this book as a whole trying, you know, doing literary from his perspective of a complete novel? What exactly is this book trying to do?
Well, I mean, I think my favorite part of the book, I've said it on other podcasts, is chapter 10, even though it's very short. And I wouldn't necessarily call it a climax, but it works for me very emotionally from the beginning of it, where he's just listing all these people who died, like Robert Kennedy died, Martin Luther King died. He says, every day my government gives me a count of corpses created by military science in Vietnam. His dad died. Even the guns were rusting. You know, just time goes on. People die. You know, some of it is politically motivated. You know, murder or deaths or assassinations or whatever. And some of it is just old age. And it all comes together for me in this just great sadness and I'm not sure if it comes from an anger about Vietnam, maybe, but I don't know. I don't sense that. Just everything is so tragic to me. And then, of course, it ends on a completely, I don't know, not a note that you wouldn't say is either tragic or not. It's this bird saying "pooty weet," and you're like, "Oh, what's going on here? What is he saying? Is he saying anything? Is he saying that he can't say anything about all of this death and destruction?" I don't know. It all works for me, anyway.
Well, I'll say it worked for me in a similar sense, that it all the contradiction kind of flying back and forth in this book and the constant jumping around of scene, I was not expecting to kind of have the same, when I'm reading a really kind of engaging novel, there's kind of a ramping effect, whereas you get further and further into the story, it becomes harder and harder to put it down as you get more and more engaged in the characters. And that's not exactly the same reason, but I had the same feeling as I was reading this book, that this constant kind of jittery energy that the book has going back and forth really kind of affected me more than I expected at the end here. And I think it has something to do with the way that Vonnegut is able to kind of make this into a single whole, that somehow it's possible to read this book almost as a Tralfalmadorian might, with kind of getting the whole picture at once, or at least as much as it's possible in a book that you have to read from start to finish and left to right.
And also maybe it's because it goes back full circle to the first chapter where he's with O'Hare again, and we transition from Billy saying to Rumford, "I was there," to Vonnegut again saying for himself, "I was there," and O'Hare was there. So we have this blending again of the fiction and the real, and returning to the real, and maybe returning to realer emotions, and trying to, I don't know, connect all of the stuff that he just said through this fictional character and all of these fun science fictional, you know, episodes, and finally bringing it back to where we started, to, you know, this guy who's trying to deal with the fact that he's gone through this tragic event and trying to figure out how to put it in a novel that other people could understand, or that he could even understand. So, yeah, that works for me very well.
And we promised we'd come back to it. So, Matt, is this book fatalistic?
I mean, I think that it's about the fatalism is about the sort of the subjective experience of sort of feeling caught in history, right? Like, I get from that last, from the opening of chapter 10, a sense of hopelessness, right? That's not a like an ontological statement about like whether or not we have free will. Is that ontology properly, or is that, you know, a different branch of philosophy? I don't know. So it goes. But the overriding, I mean, the impression that I'm left with, right, is one of like of hopelessness, of having not learned. Not learn the lessons of the past, right? Like military science seems to call back Truman's announcement that Rumford has in the hospital, where he talks about sort of magnifying the destructive power of our weapons, you know, and the idea that like we have harnessed the energy of the sun and some other kind of scientistic stuff that's in the that's in that speech, you know, and like these are corpses created by military science, and they're not. I mean, it's funny to describe them as corpses created. You don't think of corpses being created. You think of living of life, right, being extinguished, right, not of corpses created. And there is something like very hopeless, or there's something that kind of could lead one to feel hopeless in the idea that there are these enormous corpse creating machines, you know, he also calls out the you know, peculiar horror of napalm in Vietnam. I don't mean peculiar. I mean particular horror of napalm in Vietnam, and with its reference to Kilgore Trout back a couple chapters ago. I think that it's so. Why do I bring all this up? Well, I think that so much of this book is about trying to find a way to bear witness, and trying to find a language and a technique that will allow Vonnegut to bear witness to what he experienced and what he saw in a way that you can bear witness to in some sense the actuality of it. And right, like it's with sort of literary modernism after the First World War and sort of postmodernism after the Second World War, though that's not strictly true, that's a little too schematic, but you know, it'll do for now, right? You have this sense of sort of grappling with a new world. And one of the features of this new world that literature has to grapple with and has to create new techniques and new kinds of combination and bricolage and what have you to grapple with is the postmodern sense of being stuck without any agency in the world. And so I would say that that all the fatalistic stuff is about the subjective experience of feeling like you don't have any control, of feeling like there's no hero, of feeling like the end of World War II just kind of comes, right? And you're locked in your barn, you're sleeping there, and then somewhere in there was springtime. One morning they got up to discover the door was unlocked, right? Like, it's kind of like Jesus was resurrected and he just kind of wandered out and pushed the stone from the inside and it rolled away without any action happening, right? Without any climax or confrontation, without any heroism or agency being exercised. It just happened to you. I don't know. That's how I read the fatalism in it, and not as a sort of philosophical statement that's supposed to reduce to an internally consistent, philosophy about how life is and what the real meaning of things are.
I think I largely agree. I think what you say about bearing witness is particularly important. I think trying to frame, you have to get kind of at a deep philosophical root of saying there is no free, these are the way things are, because I think so often when there's a witness, when there's someone coming forward and saying, not making an argument from statistics or not trying to sum up what happened globally, but somebody simply coming forward and saying, these things happened to me, there's always kind of a suspicion at the back of everyone's mind that there's somehow a moral calculus going on, that when I say this thing happened to me, I'm somehow accusing someone of something, or I have some sort of agenda. And I think he's trying to tell his story in a way that evades that, where it simply is a bearing witness of this thing that happened. This frequently happens, particularly among lawyers, because, of course, eyewitnesses are very unreliable in court, and they're very hard to build your case around eyewitness testimony. But you'll often hear people completely discount it, and they'll say, well, there's no evidence that this thing happened, even though there are actual living, breathing people who will, if you ask them, come into court and say that this thing happened. Because I think there's this idea of attaching a moral valence to even the most mundane of stories. And so when you're coming forward and saying, like Billy Pilgrim is like, I was there, I saw this thing happen, and we have to grapple with that. He's trying to break down all of these preconceived notions we have about the way people tell stories in order to get that taken even at face value.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. That the same way that Billy was in Dresden and, tells people about it sometimes, he was also in a zoo on an alien planet and gets in a lot of trouble for telling people about that. Even though, as far as he's concerned, it's equally real. Like, it is exactly the same kind of thing. This happened, and then this happened, and both of these things are part of his experience, and some of them are more okay to talk about than others in certain circumstances, and then sometimes they're not. Right? Like, the degree to which people are willing to listen to his being in his, being in Dresden, how does that compare, subjectively to how willing they are to listen, to him, talking about how he was kidnapped by aliens and forced to mate with a porn star, and then, and he travels back in time and all of these things. Like, for him, these are just the things that happened. There's no argument, from his perspective, these are the facts. But getting anybody else with their different experiences and their subjective beliefs to treat these things as objectively as they occurred to Billy is a completely different subject.
What that may speak to partially is how to put this. One reason why people tend to discount other people's witnessing, other people's testimony, is because, as Ben was saying, they think that you're telling this story for some kind of rhetorical purpose. You're trying to get something out of it. But there are other reasons, right? Sometimes it's simply inconvenient for us for someone to have witnessed such and such a thing. And, if they say, I witnessed someone, kidnapping me and putting me on a flying saucer, we are likely to sort of shoo that person away. If they say, I witnessed the bombing of Dresden, then we have to deal with them in another sense, right?
Or do we?
Right.
Because it depends why. It depends why they're telling us. Like, oh, you were in Dresden, therefore you have some extra insight into the morality of it, or maybe that's the motivation for your telling it. Maybe you really were kidnapped by aliens, or maybe you just want to feel important and want people to pay attention to you. You know, it's kind of telling stories like these, I think, can arouse people's suspicion as to what your motivation is for telling them. Like, what? Yeah, so you were there. Like, so what? Maybe that happened and maybe that didn't. But what's the point of you actually telling this story? Why are you doing it?
Or even without the motivation thing, sometimes you'll just sort of ignore somebody's story, right? Like, I've done it. I'm not proud of it. But sometimes people tell me, like, so then this thing happened, then this thing happened. And, like, somewhere behind my conscious mind, it's like there's a little sensor who's like, would it be really convenient for you to have to work out all of the sort of ramifications of that thing they told you just happened? No, not convenient. How about just ignore the fact that they told you that? And I feel like that's something that we all do a lot more than we would like to, you know, or that we would like to admit.
I do wonder, though, if there is a little political motivation, just a teensy bit, because he did note in the previous chapter for quite a while that the bombing of Dresden was kept secret by the government for a long time because they claim, I think, was it Rumford who said it? I forget. They had to keep it secret because the Bleeding Hearts might come out and, you know, start complaining about it, because that's the only reason you would keep it secret. And therefore, telling the story, I mean, it's not just for yourself. It's, you know, it does implicitly have some sort of there's politics in everything, is what I'm saying. And I think there is a little bit of politics in this. And I think Vonnegut is admitting it slightly just by contrasting the secrecy of it by the government versus his telling it here.
First you tell me there's Jesus imagery. Now you tell me there's a political axe to grind.
I'm just pointing things out. I you know, you've listened to me. I'm completely unintelligible on this book. Give me any reading of this book and I will try to argue it, and then I'll try to argue the other one.
It's not a political axe to grind. It's a political Luftwaffe saber to grind.
It's a political plowshare to dull.
It's a political flamethrower to flame. I don't know. What's the verb for flame throwing?
Throw flame.
Throw.
It's one of those, yeah. I threw flame. He, she, or it hath thrown flame.
We're waking up and quickly discovering that this podcast is almost at the end of the hour. Any final thoughts?
Pooty wheat?
If you're ever in Cody, Wyoming, just ask for Wild Bob. That's what I got to say.
That was me. That was I. That was the podcaster of this podcast.
The caster of this pod.
Well, thanks, guys. This has been great talking about the book. Of course, we'll be back next week to talk about the film adaptation, which I understand was very well received. So I'm looking forward to watching it and talking about it with you and everybody on the site. Of course, we'll still have the forums open for both these chapters. And we also opened a separate forum thread if you want to talk about the whole book. And until then, we thank you for bearing witness to this podcast. You can visit us on the web at www.overthinkingit.com, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny
it probably doesn't deserve.
God grant me the serenity to subject the popular culture I can subject to a level of scrutiny it doesn't deserve, to a level of scrutiny it doesn't deserve.
I believe it's pronounced serentity.